on him, and the little boy sees this big box, and it's in front of him, and he opens up the package. Now, the camera is right on the little boy's face, and you can see that anticipation. And you know what that's like. It's exciting to have that anticipation of something. I mean, you probably see that on my face right now, anticipation of that meal we're going to go eat in a few minutes downstairs. There's that excited anticipation. Good things are coming. I heard there might even be pecan pie. It's a really good day. So the little boy's face is all lit up. He is all excited about this opportunity to open this gift. And so he rips off the paper like a little boy would. But when he opens the paper, there in front of him, the camera pans in and you see what the boy's looking at. It says, pottery wheel. Now, at first, the little boy is kind of like stunned, right? This wasn't what he was expecting. And so at first, there's this look on his face, like, huh? And then he reads it again, pottery wheel. And then there's that expression that begins to change to disappointment. He looks at it a third time, pottery wheel. And then you see the anger come into the little boy's face. And he picks up this box and he tosses it across the room and runs out of the room crying. Right? He's devastated. Things didn't turn out like he was expecting at all. Have you ever been there? Have you ever bought a ticket to a concert to find out that the show was not worth going to at all, or to a movie that you were disappointed, maybe even left halfway through, or you bought tickets to a football game, hoping the home team would come through big, only to find out it went the other way? Disappointment. We have great expectations, but sometimes the field goal kicker misses the game-winning field goal, and things don't go our way. Or maybe it's another kind of anticipation. A lot of you have been married, and on a wedding day, there is anticipation on two faces. But I've seen in marriages where those looks become kind of like that little boy. First, a little disappointment, then a little bit of anger, and then feeling like we have to run out of the room. Sometimes that's how life is. Challenges, unexpected twists and turns, things don't go the way we think they would go. And that is certainly the case in this story. This is the story of Ruth. If you've been reading through the story, we're in week number 9. We're almost a third of the way through our campaign, believe it or not. You're reading through the Bible, and it's a remarkable journey that we're on. And this week you read this remarkable book, the book of Ruth. It almost seems out of place in the Bible because in this story, there are no obvious big miracles. We don't see the parting of the Red Sea. There aren't angels or armies that show up. It's just ordinary people living their lives. And what a story it is. Here's this Jewish family, a woman named Naomi and her husband Elimelech. They have a parcel of land in Bethlehem. And there they are in Bethlehem with their land, and a famine comes. Now, here we are in the Promised Land, God's great place that he's going to give us. And it was the time of the judges, and probably because of the wickedness of the people in part, or maybe just because of life, because sometimes hardship comes into life, a famine comes. In the midst of the famine, things get desperate. I imagine it would kind of be like if you had a family and you were working, let's say you were the man of the family and you were working, or the one of the family who had the income, and you went to your employer and they said, hey, you've lost your job. And so you go back and you speak to your spouse and you say, you know what, I think it's bad. I've lost my job. I think we can make it. And we'll kind of hold out for a while and maybe something better will happen. And so at first you go through whatever savings you had, and then you might go through whatever borrowing capacity you have in your credit card, but pretty soon you come to the realization, you say, you know what? Something's got to give. We can't do this any longer. Something has to change. Well, the famine kind of did this to Elimelech and Naomi. It pushed them to the place where they had to give up their property. They had lived on this property. It was theirs, their inheritance. It would always be theirs. God had promised that to them. But this famine was so severe that I imagine one night lying in bed, Elimelech says to Naomi, you know what? Naomi, we have to leave. To make matters worse, to find a place where the harvest was good and the famine hadn't affected them, they would have to go to Moab, the land of their sworn enemies, the descendants of those people of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where they would have to go. Not exactly the promised land. for a Jewish person. Humbling, scary. Incredibly, though, Naomi would say in the story as you read it that when she gets ready to leave, that she left full. She left with enough. And I think I can imagine that Naomi was a person who probably thought to herself, you know what, honey? You are a great husband. As long as I have you and I have our boys, it'll be okay. Wherever we be, that wherever we will be, that will be home. And it'll be okay wherever we are. And so even though she was leaving her family and leaving her friends and leaving her property and leaving everything that she has known, she's happy. Not happy that it's all happening, but happy because she still has her husband and her sons. And she's come to the place in Naomi that that's what really mattered to her. So she goes off to Moab because of this famine. And as she goes off on this journey, we read in the first chapter of the book of Ruth that while she's there, that her husband, Elimelech, dies. Now, this is really tough, but she still has her two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And so while she's there with her sons can still help to provide for her. Remember, it's a time and a culture where it was difficult, though not impossible, for women to have economic means, but it was difficult. And I'm sure life was very difficult for a foreigner in a strange land. I'm sure it was very difficult. She has her two sons, and she's doing the best she can by her sons, but they're living in a foreign culture, and her sons say, Mom, we want to get married. And we have found these two beautiful Moabite women that we want to marry. And you know, I have to imagine that old Naomi knew that this was against God's rule, that God had told the children of Israel not to marry these other people, but to marry within the culture of Israel. In the culture of faith, these people worshiped a false god. They engaged in pagan practices. God did not want them to intermarry. But Naomi is a mom with two grown boys in a foreign place who is dependent on her sons. And whether she liked it or not, she allows it to happen. And her sons marry these women of Moab, Orpah and Ruth. Now, for a decade, life goes on. And it sounds like God has taken care of Naomi through her sons and her daughters-in-laws, and she has enjoyed their company. And although she might not have felt as full as she once did when she had her husband and all of her boys together, she's still finding a way to make it. But then, her sons die. And now, here she is, going up in years, in a foreign land, no longer able to count on her children or her husband to take care of her, in a culture that has no reason to take care of her. She's a foreigner with her daughter-in-laws. But it's in that moment that she hears some encouraging news. She hears that back in Bethlehem, back in the Promised Land, there is grain once again in abundance. And like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz, I think she kind of clicks her heels together and she thinks, well, there's no place like home. And so she begins the preparation to go home. And you know what happens in the story. Orpah and Ruth are there, and they don't want her to go. They want to stay with her. And they say to her, you know, hey, we want to be with you. And Naomi says, no. You go home to your own mothers. You go home to your own families. And eventually, Orpah is persuaded to go. But then there's this beautiful pledge that's made. And take a look at this. It's from the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. And a lot of you will have heard this passage because it's oftentimes read at weddings. When Naomi's trying to send Ruth home to her mother, Ruth says this to Naomi. Ruth chapter 1, verse 16. Ruth says, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. Now, we usually hear that at weddings, but if we were going to do this in context, what we would have to do is tell the groom, step aside for a moment, go get his mom from the front row and bring her up there so she could say these to her mother-in-law. Probably not going to happen at any wedding anytime soon, right? What a remarkable promise. I mean, it says something. She must have been a really good mother-in-law. But she also was a good friend. And it speaks a lot about Ruth and her love for Naomi. And so it is that Ruth and Naomi now head for Bethlehem. Now, as the story continues to unfold, and this unlikely friendship has begun to develop between Ruth and Naomi, and I say unlikely because I suspect that although many have a good relationship with their mother-in-law, most wouldn't say, I want to live with my mother-in-law for the rest of my life. But Ruth and Naomi have that kind of a friendship. And so they head back towards Bethlehem just at harvest time, or we could say a time just like right now, like our Thanksgiving. The barley harvest is on, and as they get there and they come to that place in Bethlehem, as soon as the people in the village see Naomi, they say, is that Naomi? Naomi's name meant full or joyful. But what does she say to them? She says, no, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, which means bitter. For God has treated me bitterly or with hardship. It says something that she's kind of frustrated with how her life's turned out. And how could God let this happen to me? Maybe you can relate. God ever let you down? Or at least, did it seem that way? One of the reasons people say they don't come to church or they don't have faith is that at some critical moment in their life when they felt like they really needed God, they felt like He just let them down. He wasn't there when they needed Him most. We can feel that way, but we must be cautious. Because just like in this story, our feelings can deceive us. And we don't always know how God is working. In this story, especially, that's true. It's hard for us to know. It was hard for Naomi and Ruth to see how God was at work in the most difficult moment. God was at work. In this time that seemed like the worst moment was about to unlock the best moment. It was remarkable what was about to happen in the story. And so they return at the harvest time, and after they've gotten back home, Naomi and Ruth are there, and they don't have jobs, and they need to eat. And Ruth says, Mom, can I go out and find one of the farmers who's harvesting in the field, and I'll just follow behind the workers, and out of the scraps, kind of, so to speak, that fall, the stalks that fall behind, I'll pick off some of the barley to bring home. And she says, yeah, that'd be great, daughter. That'd be great. And so Ruth goes out to the field. Now, there are lots of fields around, but the one she happens, the Bible uses an interesting phrase, as it turned out, the field belonged to Boaz, who happened to be family, not close family, but family to Naomi. And she works in the field. And as it turned out in the story, Boaz had been away on some trip, but he arrives on the field the same day that Ruth has arrived in his field. And boy, does she ever catch his eye, because as soon as he sees her, he says to his men, he says, hey, who is that woman out there gleaning in my field? I mean, it caught his eye. And it was a small town, Bethlehem was. And his workers already knew the whole story. News had traveled fast. And so they tell Boaz all the details of the story. And Boaz is thinking all this over, and he says, why don't we invite her to lunch? Now, this wasn't the custom, but he does it. And he invites her to come over to lunch and to eat with them and have lunch with them, kind of a romantic twist all on its own. He wants to know more about her. After he spends some time with her, he, of course, is ordered his men. He says, now nobody bother her. I don't have this. I'm happily married to my wife. I was talking to my son about a young lady that I thought, hey, you should probably ask her out sometime. I know a dad shouldn't do those things, but I couldn't help myself. My son says, well, Dad, I could, but that's against the bro code. I said, what in the world is the bro code? He says, well, I've got this friend, and he would like to ask that girl out, so I can't ask her out. And I said, oh, the bro code, I got it now, okay. Well, in this case, what is he saying? Oh, Boaz is saying, hey, this is the bro code, guys. If anyone's going to ask her out, it's going to be me, all right? So he kind of puts that out in front of him. He says, hey, you're not going to ask her out, and don't bother, protect her. In fact, he says, take a little of the stalks that are full of barley and just toss them off behind you and lay them in the field so that she can pick and have a lot to harvest that day. And so she does. He talks to her then about all this, and he says, hey, I want you to stay in my field. You'll be protected here. You can drink water here. And he tells her, and he gives this beautiful passage in Ruth chapter 2, verse 11. I want us to catch this because this is a great passage. Ruth chapter 2, beginning in verse 11, he says this to Ruth. Boaz, I'll start in verse 11, I guess. He says this, Boaz replied, I have been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law, Ruth, since the death of your husband, how you left your father and your mother and your homeland, and you came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Isn't that a beautiful image? That we can take refuge under the wings of the Lord? That's a beautiful image that Boaz understood that God was a God who takes people in. And in fact, Boaz is making a claim here, isn't he? He's claiming even this foreign woman is welcome. Even this person who's worshipped another god is welcome to come and be under the wings of God. It's quite a remarkable statement that God's love and his grace extends to people that we might not say are allowed to be in the club. But he says, come in. May God extend this to you. He's living out what Israel was supposed to be. Do you remember? We've talked about this in the story already. Israel was to be a nation that would bless other people. That all the nations of the earth would be blessed by Israel. That it would be a nation that would point people towards God. What's Boaz doing? He is saying to this foreigner, hey, God has a place for you under his wings. That's a great message. It's an encouraging message. Well, as the story goes, and this was a remarkable story, Boaz then has worked hard, and he sends Ruth back home that day to Naomi, and Ruth tells Naomi everything that's happened in the day's events, and old Naomi kind of perks up a little bit. She kind of comes like the matchmaker and fiddler on the roof. She says, huh? I mean, I know a parent's not supposed to talk to their kids about this, but she says, hey, let me tell you, Ruth, what you might want to do is you might want to go down to that threshing floor, put on some Chanel number 5, take a bath, clean up a little bit, and here's what you do. You wait till old Boaz he's worked hard all day, wait till he's had his dinner because, you know, you don't want to get in the way of him and his food. And after he's had his dinner and after he's worked hard all day on the threshing floor up there and he falls asleep, what you're going to do is after he's asleep, you're going to go down there by his feet, uncover his feet, and lay down. Now, ladies, this is not a formula for how to get a man in the new era, okay? You might go to prison for stalking, all right? Don't do this today. But she says, this is what you're doing. This was a cultural thing in the day of their culture. And Naomi says, because he is a part of our family. And she's making a hint at something here called the Levirate, the Levirate Commission, which was a responsibility to make sure that everyone has an heir for the sake of property. It was an Old Testament custom. And so she's making a hint about it, although it doesn't discuss it in the text. That's what's at play here. And so she goes and she does what she's supposed to do. Now, I know there's all kinds of speculation about this event, but this is kind of how it plays out. And let's take it for the innocence that the Bible presents it and not try to make it something untoward. It presents it as though in the middle of the night, old Boaz kicks his feet around and he feels something at his feet that doesn't feel like the threshing floor. And he says, huh, what's this all about? And then, of course, that has awoken Ruth, although I doubt she ever slept that night. And she says to him something remarkable. And I want us to take a look at that passage as well. It's in the third chapter, and we'll pick it up in about verse number 9. And she says something remarkable. So as Boaz has kicked her in the night, or he discovers she's there, he asks who she is, and she says, "I am your servant Ruth." She says, "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." The idea that he would redeem the property, redeem this and produce an heir. Now, when she says, "Spread your garment over me," you know what she's saying? The word for garment in Hebrew is the same exact word for wing. Isn't that interesting? It's the same exact word. It's a play on words, but it's the same thing he said, "May God extend his wing and send his protection over you." And she is saying to him, "Extend your protection over me." Now don't miss, this also had the connotation, for this to happen, they would have to get married. You got to picture that Boaz is probably a good 15, 20 years older than Ruth is. And you got to also picture in the story that he's a single bachelor who has been quite successful. There's no reason for us to believe he's ever had a wife before. And all of a sudden, the prettiest girl in the field comes and says, "You know what, I wouldn't mind having you for a husband." Now that is kind of forward. And old Boaz, well, he's in shock. He can't believe she would pick him. "You what?" In fact, he gives her six measures of barley, which would be almost impossible for her to carry home. And he sends her back to Naomi. And she goes back to Naomi, and Naomi talks to Ruth, right? And Naomi and Ruth are talking, and Naomi, the wise matchmaker, says, "Don't worry. The sun is not going to go down today until old Boaz is taken care of what has to be taken care of." In other words, she was saying, "Don't worry, I think he's smitten with you, and he's going to work all these things out." Now, here's what he had to work out. Under the Jewish law, it was the closest family member who had the right, the levirate right, to provide an heir, and in providing an heir, he would also take that property as his own until the time the heir grew up, then the heir would receive the property. So it had some economic advantages. And old Boaz knows that. And so he calls a meeting that next morning of all the town council. He says, "Everybody come out here and let's find out how we can make this work." He says, "This woman has come and someone needs to claim this property." And he asks this guy who's supposed to do it, "Do you want it?" And the guy says, "Sure, I want that property." He says, "No problem. There's this one catch. You got to take this one woman as your wife." And the guy says, "Whoa, I've already got a wife, and this would really mess up things in my family if I do that. It could even jeopardize my estate." He says, "No, I don't think so." And so Boaz says, "Are you sure? Are you sure you don't want it? You know, are you really sure?" He says, "Yeah, I don't want it. You can have it." And so in front of all the leaders of the village, he says, "All right, we're going to shake on it." In their day, they had this other weird custom. Instead of just shaking hands, they exchanged smelly shoes. I don't know why. It was just the custom of the day. Now, I'm not going to seal any deals anytime soon by giving off my shoe. You don't want that. That's a bad part of the deal. But for them, this is what they did. So they exchanged sandals and they sealed the deal. And then the end of that story comes. The end of that story is that they get married. And it's not very long until they have a son. A little boy named Obed. And you got to picture old Naomi with her grandson bouncing on her lap. And here's what it all meant. She's back home in her own property because it's her family's again. Boaz is letting her live in the old house. And here this woman whose life had been filled with bitterness is holding her grandbaby on her lap. And man, that is awesome. It's exciting. Everything that looks so bitter now looks bountiful and wonderful. It's a great Thanksgiving. It's a wonderful life. Things have totally turned around. In fact, they've turned around more than Naomi or Ruth or Boaz or little Obed could ever know. It's a remarkable story. In a lot of ways, it's remarkable. You got to go to the book of Matthew to understand just how incredibly it is. In Matthew chapter 1, we read this interesting thing about the lineage of Jesus himself. It says this in Matthew chapter 1. In the family tree of Jesus, it says, "Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab." Whoa, 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 whoa. Now that's a name you know, right? We better stop there for a minute. You know this Rahab. Remember, we just talked about her 2 weeks ago. Rahab, the harlot, the prostitute, the woman in the wall, the one who let the spies in, the one who helped. She was the traitor to her people at Jericho so that the Israelites, in part, could understand their adversary, and God spared her and her life. And she had been allowed to come into their culture. And she had married perhaps even one of the spies, I think. And she had had a son. And she had experienced God's wing over her, allowing her, a foreign woman, an enemy, to come live among them. And she had been brought into their family. And Boaz had been raised knowing that. And here was this woman who once had been let in to become a part of Israel, who now invites a foreigner into his household and says, "You come live among me." And oh, by the way, let's read the rest of that family tree, because it says, Obed, whose mother was Ruth, was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of King David. God was at work in the story. God was at work in the story. It's just an ordinary story about life. It's just, it couldn't get any more ordinary. Just people going about their lives every day. But God was doing big things in ordinary people. They didn't know it. They didn't know that in four generations, the greatest king that the nation would ever know was going to come out of their lineage. They would never know that. They couldn't have imagined that God had that plan, but he had it at work. And they could never have guessed that the Messiah was going to be born right there in Bethlehem, maybe even on their property. They could never have known. But you know what? God knew. Because God is telling the big story. And he knows the end of all things. Could it be that right now, in the middle of your worst moment, God is doing some of his biggest things? I got to tell you, that's incredible when God does that. God is at work in a big story in your life right now. Sometimes it's exciting. Like when my friend Christian Wickman picked up that fumble in Friday night's football game and ran it for a touchdown. And East wins and goes to the state championship on Saturday. That's exciting stuff. God's at work in that. Or sometimes he's at work in some other way. I bought a house a few months ago. And I had a vision that I would do a couple of minor repairs, and I would move in. And now here we are. By the grace of God, we'll get in that house soon. I promise Susan G., who's let me live in her home, someday we'll get out of your home and move into our own. God is at work. And day after day and week after week, people of this congregation come and they serve, and we eat together sometimes, we work together sometimes, we cough in the dust a lot of the time, and we enjoy each other's fellowship, and it's been remarkable. I'm getting closer to the church, and I am humbled. I am so thankful today for the amount of generous support and help we've received. It's mind-boggling. It's made something that would sink me financially completely doable, because it's just a great thing. God's working in a difficult situation. God is working, and I'm blessed in the middle of that. It's awesome. Well, God is working among us. In fact, God sent us a couple of years ago, this young couple that said to us when we were looking for blast sponsors downstairs, they said, "You know what, we'd love to do that. We'd love to help out with that." And all of a sudden we recognized we had this dynamic duo. Zach and Julie, come up here for a minute. A lot of you know them through the things they do, because they help out in our blast program. They help out teaching Sunday school. They helped out in Vacation Bible School. They help out in all kinds of things. And they help me out on Sunday night leading worship. They're a fantastic young couple. And God's been at work in their story. And today I'm excited to tell you that this is the newest partner in ministry that Ogleville Christian Church has, in Zach and Julie Riggs. And we are partnering with them. And as a congregation, you will be helping to send them off to seminary. He's going for his master's degree from Lincoln Christian University over the next 3 years. And we have asked Zach and Julie, when they finish those 3 years and along the way, to be ministry partners with us. And while we're not defining what that partnership has to look like in entirety, although the term associate minister floats around in my mind a lot, we are pursuing that, and they have agreed to give the church, to serve the church for 3 more years after they have done their Bible college time. And well, the last guy that came here for 3 years has stayed for 16. So we'll see how that works out. But God is at work, and so I'm excited. So join me in welcoming the newest ministry partners to the church. God is at work in a story, Zach and Julie. What do you have to say about that?
Well, when I think back a few years ago when we started joining this church, and if somebody had told me, hey, in a few years you're going to be standing up there and you're going to be becoming ministry partners, I would have been scared to death, absolutely scared to death. But when I think towards the future and I look at this time now, I can look back and think, wait a minute, when I... 3 years ago, or however many years ago we were, I was thinking more in the terms of I can't believe that I would ever be standing in front of you. Well, the thing is, and the difference is now, I recognize and I realize that I am, it's not an I, it's an us. It's me, it's Julie, and it's especially God. God is with us, and we're a team. And because of that team, I'm able to stand up here in front of you and tell you that I'm super excited to get started on this question journey, and know that even though we're starting on this road, and there's going to be some bumps and some, you know, potholes, we're going to make it. We're going to get there, and we're going to do awesome things for God with your help as well.
All right, welcome. Thanks, guys. God is at work. God is at work in ordinary things. Forever and ever and ever, we've talked about how are we going to expand and how are we going to grow. And this week, by the grace of God, this week, the first parcel of land will be purchased next door. It's almost there. We're at the end of that. Of course, then we got to pay for it, but you people pay for things pretty quick around here, so I don't think that'll be a problem. God blesses us in rich and generous ways. It's amazing what God's doing. I don't have to tell you that God is at work. I remember that Sunday, that Thanksgiving Sunday, 16 years ago. There were about 40 of you here that day. That's all that was here that day. And we sat here and we watched a film. A few of you remember, the film was called The Harvest. It was really hard to imagine that we would have a sanctuary that was filled like this, because this attendance today is bigger than the first 10 Easters that we had together. All right? And this is just an average old week. Well, maybe not. Today is Pecan Pie Sunday, so we won't call it average, but it's above average, but still, it's a good day. But God is at work, right? God is at work. And he's got bigger things yet to do. Not only will this year blow away any attendance number we've ever had, and great things are happening. I talked to Mark and Sherry yet, and the people are running our youth program right now, and they're doing a great job. And they tell you night after night how that they are blowing out, Thursday night, blowing the doors off this place. It's packed. They need more space. I talked to our teachers downstairs, and Betsy runs the children's program, and she talks about our time and we worship. And she says, we got to have more space. We have too many kids. We got to have more space. And it would be easy for me to be like old Naomi. Oh, this is hard. This is so hard. But you know what I believe? God is at work in the story. And there are always better things coming. Because God knows how the story is going to end. I believe God has great things in store for us, and I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful in the difficult days when we lose a person that's been faithful to us for years in ministry and service, and we lose them to death, or when God takes them to serve in another field, and we mourn their absence, and we think, boy, how are we going to go forward now? But God always provides what is needed. He'll do the same thing for you. He wants to do the same exact thing for you. If you're here today and you're in that tough spot, we want to come alongside of you. We want to minister with you, pray with you, encourage you, and if we can, help you in some way. So I want to let you know this is a place today where you can get help if you're in a desperate spot. If that's your circumstance, I'm more than willing to stay and sit and pray with you. The elders are willing to do that. The people in the pew are willing to do that. We're willing to come alongside of you right now and to do that. Maybe you're a person that you have felt the sting of the loss of someone around you. It's hard for you to be at peace because you're mourning. That was Naomi. But be encouraged. be encouraged that you really aren't alone, even if it feels that way. That God is with you, that there are family members with you, and be encouraged that God there is an end to loneliness, and that God brings joy back into the most lonely of hearts. It may be this morning that part of the thing you feel is the absence of Christ because you've never made him your Lord and Savior. Now that's a kind of loneliness that can only be filled, that void can only be filled by accepting Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. If you'd like to make Jesus Christ your Lord and Savior, then I invite you to do that by walking the aisle and confessing Jesus as Christ and being baptized today in this space. If that's a decision God's laid in your heart, would you make it as we stand and we sing our invitation hymn?